Welcome to The Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. Two quick things before we get to the show. First, we've set up a short, super easy Politics Guys listener survey. There are only 7 questions and all of them are completely optional. Your responses will be extremely helpful to us as we work to expand and improve the show. To take the survey, go to our website, politicsguys.com, and click on the link you'll see in our listener survey post. Thanks a lot. Now, if you've been to our website, politicsguys.com, in the past, you may have found yourself thinking, wow, this could really use some work. I totally agree, and that brings me to the second quick thing. We would like to modernize our design, making it more user-friendly and optimizing it for mobile viewing. Now, if you're a web designer with WordPress experience who might be interested in helping us out, I'd love to talk with you. You can reach me at mike@politicsguys.com. Thanks. And now, on to the show. My guest today is Ganesh Sitaraman, a professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's been a longtime advisor to Senator Elizabeth Warren, serving as her policy director and senior counsel. Professor Sitaraman has commented on foreign and domestic policy in the New York Times, the New Republic, the Boston Globe, and the Christian Science Monitor, and is the author of The Counterinsurgent's Constitution, Law in the Age of Small Wars, which won the 2013 Palmer Civil Liberties Prize, and most recently, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Income Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Professor Sitaraman, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
You know, I really enjoyed your book, and I was particularly intrigued by something I'd never really thought about before, your discussion of 2 different types of constitutional design, class warfare and middle class. And I was hoping we could start out by you giving us an explanation of what these models are.
Sure. You know, most of the time when we think about constitutions today and how they're structured, we think about federalism, the power between the national government and the state government. And we think about the separation of powers, the division of power between the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. But for much of the history of constitutional design, people were actually very, very worried about the problem of economic inequality. And so when they thought about the structures of constitutions, they partly thought about the problem of inequality. And throughout history, one of the great fears was that in a deeply divided society where there's a rich and a poor, the rich will try to oppress the poor, the poor would try to confiscate the wealth of the rich, and the result would be strife, violence, and maybe even revolution. And so the question for constitutional design was there any way to stop these kind of constant conflicts and revolutions from taking place? And so the answer was a constitutional strategy that I call class warfare constitutions. And the idea here is that you build class directly into the structure of government. So in ancient Rome, for example, there's a Senate, which is for the patricians, the wealthiest people. And then there's a tribune of the plebs, the plebeians, which is a representative of the poor. In England, we have a House of Lords for the wealthy and a House of Commons for everybody else. And the idea is that these two branches of government provide a check against each other, but also give a share and a stake in governing to both the wealthiest people in society and to ordinary people. And that's what creates stability. Now, the other type of government that thinkers starting with Aristotle came up with was what I call a middle-class constitution. And the idea of that is if you don't really have a big rich and poor, if you have a society in which everyone is relatively equal and everyone's in the middle class, then you won't need these class warfare kind of structures. And you could have a true republic or even a democracy. Because everyone is relatively equal, you won't have the kind of class warfare that comes from economic inequality.
Now, the framers, right, they ended up going with a middle-class constitution. And I'm wondering, for the time, how unusual was that choice over, you know, a class warfare model? And what convinced them that this was what the basis of the new nation should be?
It was incredibly radical. I mean, this was one of the greatest shifts in constitutional history that the framers of our Constitution instituted, there's a major shift that happens, because basically from the ancient world all the way up until the founding of America, people had relied on the class warfare design, and they didn't believe it was really possible to have a middle-class constitution in most societies, because there was simply too much inequality. And what the founding generation believes instead is that America is exceptional, and it's exceptional because of the relative economic equality in the country.
And you know, that really surprised me when I read about your account of this period, that economic inequality was actually really low around this time in 18th century America. I mean, I guess I'd always assumed for some reason that there was this, you know, wealthy elite class and all the founders belonged to it, and there was a significant number of poor, but I guess the conditions at the time were different than that. And so I'm wondering, what exactly was it about that time that promoted such a, I guess, relatively high degree of economic equality?
So the first thing that I'll say is that, you know, there's always a division between people who are wealthier and people who are less well off. So it's not as if in the founding era there was perfect equality. But for the baselines that they were comparing themselves with, the first is Europe, so the countries of England, France, and so on. And then second was history, the things they were reading in history books about Rome and Greece and the Italian city-states and so on. They thought that they were incredibly equal in relation to any other country that existed in the history of the world or that existed in the world at that time. And people in the founding generation say exactly that. And the reason why they believe this is first, there's no feudalism in America, no system of lords and serfs like there was in Europe. There was no hereditary aristocracy in America. And third, there was no severe restriction on the amount of land. They saw that there was a lot of land available, and that the West was wide and expansive. And what this meant was that any white man, and it was limited to white men as who they saw within the political community at that time, and that is a severe restriction, which we can talk more about if you'd like to. But within that political community, as they understood it, there was relative equality and an opportunity for people to become landowners, and land was the main form of wealth. What's also striking, I think, is there are some economic historians, Peter Lindert at Berkeley, and what they have done is shown that they recreated the kind of income profile of early America. And what they find is that in 1774, right on the edge of the American Revolution, America is shockingly equal. And in fact, the South, the most unequal part of America, when you're including slavery, you know, especially unequal, the South in 1774 is as unequal as America in 2012. In contrast, the North, the New England states, in 1774, you know, look more similar to Scandinavia after the welfare state, after taxes and transfer, and you know, they had no welfare state back in 1774. So it was a different kind of set of conditions, and they were actually far more economically equal. These economic historians suggest, even than we are today.
Wow, that's really something. Now, even so, at that time, right, there were some framers who argued against this, who didn't really buy into this idea of a middle class constitution. And I'm wondering, given what seemed to be very good conditions at the time in terms of economic equality, what were their objections to going with this middle class constitution model?
So I'll pause for a second here and just say one of the things that wasn't an objection. So for many of these people, they were not objecting to unequal treatment of women, African Americans, and Native Americans. There were some who did, especially who were in favor of abolishing slavery and advocated for that. And there was a striking amount of democratizing spirit in the country. And so, you know, New Jersey allowed women to vote in the Revolutionary period. Pennsylvania allowed African Americans to vote. Those things were later, restrictions were placed upon those in the 19th century, but there was this amazing democratic spirit. But that wasn't the focus of where opposition was, even though today that's where we would see the real opposition, and I think for good reason. But their objections were that they worried that economic inequality was inevitable, and that what would happen is there were still going to be some people who were going to be richer than others, and that those people were going to try to take over the government and use it to serve their own interests. And the only check against that kind of thing from happening, against an aristocracy or an oligarchy, as we might call it, was having a kind of class warfare structure. And so John Adams, who's often thought of as a very elitist in how he thought about our constitutional system, talks about having a Senate that is made for the elite, not because he wants to empower the elite. He calls it an ostracism. He wants to ostracize the elite and the wealthy to the Senate so that everyone else can combine against them in the House of Representatives, and that there will be a check against the power of the elites, and for them to have, so that they don't have too much power. So that's the real objection from people, is they worry that inequality will quickly seep back in, and then that we will lose our republic.
Right. You know, some people might hear this and think, well, wouldn't the safer thing have been to go with that sort of reasoning, given how radical this is? But it seems to me, if I understand sort of the arguments for these two designs, that the problem, the fundamental problem with the class warfare constitution, is it's sort of inherently unstable. And if you have the big, vibrant middle class, you should go with the middle class model because it will probably lead to better stability. Is that more or less right? Or am I getting that right?
Yes. Yeah, so I think there's a challenge here. You know, there's a difficulty in knowing which of these is a better model. So the class warfare model, its theory is that if you have relatively stable classes of rich and poor, they can each check each other and each govern together, and you've got to have compromise in order to govern. The other theory is you have a large middle class, and that's going to be stable. And so you don't need these kind of checking mechanisms, and you get the stability in the system from the fact that, you know, people are pretty similar to each other and they have the same kind of interests. Both of them are problematic. So, you know, ancient Rome, the Roman Republic, is not the global dominant superpower in America today. And it's because the class warfare system there failed. It failed 2,000 years ago. It didn't work for them. And you saw corruption in that system. You saw bribery in that system. And so it didn't work. Similarly, though, and one of the problems that we have is that, you know, the middle class isn't necessarily going to be static and always expanding. If things change in the economy, if things change in other conditions, you might have a shrinking middle class, as we're seeing today. And so that can be a threat to our constitutional system. So both of these have some challenges. And really what it requires is active thinking about the relationship between the economic conditions in our society and the structure of our constitution in order to preserve our constitutional system.
Right. So this isn't by any means, wasn't an easy choice then for the framer, certainly.
No, and you know, there was a lot of debate about this among the framers, including in Philadelphia at the Constitutional Convention in 1787.
Now, one claim I've noticed, or one thing that came up, it seems to me, throughout the book, and there were a lot of different people in different time periods who said this, is that a strong middle class is really essential if you want to have, well, small, what I call small R Republican government. So first, for listeners who might not, you know, be entirely familiar with the term, I think there's, you know, confusion sometimes between what we mean by Republican. I was hoping you could sort of explain what a Republican form of government entails. And also then after that, if you agree with this notion that if you don't have a strong middle class, Republican government isn't going to work, at least, you know, not for long.
Yeah, so the definition of a Republican government is pretty simple. It just means representative democracy. A pure democracy is a democracy in which everybody participates. So in ancient Greece, for example, you know, heads of household, men, were all participating in government, not all the time, but there was mass participation in making the decisions over how society was going to govern itself. We don't have that situation. Most of us are not elected officials to Congress. And so what we have is a representative government. We elect people. They represent us, or at least they're supposed to represent us. And that's how our system works. It's a representative democracy, and that's what a republic is. It's a representative democracy. I think that the idea of having a strong middle class for a republic fits exactly back into what we were talking about before. So you can represent the democracy by having a strong middle class, and then you just elect officials and people are represented. And they're just representation of the people at large. If you have a very economically unequal society, another strategy for representation is you take people from different groups. And that's what the class warfare strategy was really about. The patricians are represented in the Senate. The plebeians, the poor people, are represented through the Tribune of the Plebs, or in England, the House of Commons represents the commoners. And that's how representation works. In both cases, it's a kind of representative democracy. And so I think the middle class constitution sort of smuggles in a theory of representative democracy, which is we're not representing people by class. And the reason why is we don't want to have classes and we don't have classes. And that's not the society that we live under.
Right. Now, what happens in, you know, a constitutional system like ours that's based on this notion of a strong middle class when all of a sudden the middle class isn't so strong?
Yeah, so this is a serious problem. So historically, the worry has always been that when you grow unequal, what happens is that the wealthiest people in society, the people who are rich, the people who have power, the people who have connections, will use their wealth and power in order to take over the government. And this isn't like a coup or anything like that, nothing so striking, but they'll become policymakers. They'll run for office. They will fund the people running for office through campaign contributions or bribery. They'll do things to gain power, maybe through lobbying. And what will happen is they'll influence the laws and practices of the government in order to serve their own interests rather than serving the interests of the common good and the people as a whole. And over time, this creates a vicious cycle. One commentator has called it the doom loop of oligarchy, where basically the wealthiest people use government to serve their own interests. That makes them wealthier. And then they've got even more money to try to lobby government to serve their interests even more, which makes them even wealthier. And so inequality just spirals into this system. And what happens is government becomes unrepresentative. It starts serving only the interests of a small number of people rather than the interests of everybody. And that's no longer a representative democracy. It's no longer a republic. What it turns into is something like an oligarchy, a plutocracy, an aristocracy. The idea of any of these terms is ruled by wealthy elites. And that's what is the risk of this, of losing a strong middle class when you have a constitutional system like ours.
Yeah, and I mean, there's been, as you know, as I know, there's been a ton of political science research on this that it looks at policy outcomes and policy preferences. And it's really striking to me how, well, not unanimous, but certainly there's a strong consensus, I would say, that when there is a, when people of means want a certain policy outcome, if the middle class and the lower classes don't want it in modern America, well, that's too bad, essentially, that that the upper classes get what they want much more often than not.
Yeah, there's a huge battery, as you said, of political science research over multiple years by different scholars all over the country, showing pretty consistently that policy is no longer so representative or responsive to what the people want, and that it's really a lot more responsive to the people at the very, very top, wealthiest people and big corporations. And so when people out there, whether it's Donald Trump during his campaign or Bernie Sanders, say that the system is rigged, that's what people are talking about, is this sense that it's not really responsive to what ordinary people want or need in terms of our country's policies.
Yeah, and I think the Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump sort of focus suggests that this is not really a standard left-right partisan type of issue. There are people on both sides of the ideological divide who feel that the system is no longer working for them.
That's exactly right. And I think what that shows is that, you know, this is something that we can be actually somewhat optimistic about. you know, at a time in our country where it seems like we don't agree on much of anything, and lots of people are moving into kind of tribalism and even, you know, watching different TV shows and getting their news from different sources. One thing that a lot of people agree on is that the system feels rigged to them. The economy feels rigged and the government feels rigged. And I think that's a common place where we can agree about the diagnosis, and that may help us move forward.
Yeah. Now, if we accept this, I certainly think that you're onto something here. This idea that the decline in the middle class leads to these, you know, serious problems with our constitutional order. Well, I guess one thing I think as a political scientist is, well, middle class is oftentimes one of those terms that's sort of mushy, you know, that almost everyone, when they're asked, seems to think that they're in the middle class. And so I was curious as to what you see as the middle class, the threatened middle class.
Yeah, so this is a great question. And it's one of the challenges of writing something where you especially stick middle class in the title of the book, is everyone wants to know, well, what's the middle class? And people have different views about this. Some people think it should be the median income. Some people think that it's a cultural thing that has to do with education and social status and professionalism. So there's a lot of different terms, a lot of different definitions for it. My definition is not going to be satisfying to somebody who wants a very specific dollar figure or something like that. I think what the middle class is people who are not the very rich and are not the very poor. It's a pretty simple definition. It's everybody in the middle. And the striking thing about that is that's how people throughout history have used it. And so if you go back to the founding generation, you know, it makes no sense to talk about the middle class as, did you get a college degree and were you a white collar worker? If you were a white collar worker and had a college degree in 1776, you were doing very well. You were one of the elites, not one of the middle class. So we can't use some of these definitions throughout all of history and throughout different countries. But what's striking is that even in that period, you know, they have an understanding that there is a poor, there are the rich, and then there are these other people, and they call them the middling classes or the middling sorts or those kinds of terms, which are a little clunky today. But they recognize that there is a middle between the very rich and the very poor. And that's really what we're talking about here.
You know, I think there was one point in the book, I'm going to get this wrong a little bit, but the sort of definition that came up was that the middle class are people who are pretty much doing okay for right now, and they differ from the wealthy in that the wealthy don't really have to worry about taking care of their families and themselves in the future. And that, to me, that kind of resonated. I would, you know, kind of expand it to the poor who are barely able to scrape by in the present. And to me, that intuitively just sort of made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think if we're talking about a definition for today, that's about the right definition. It's something like you feel comfortable today, but you cannot guarantee the economic future of your children. But everything is fine right now and fine for you. And on the flip side, you know, you're not so badly off that you're insecure and constantly struggling month to month. And that seems like the right kind of place for about where we think of the middle class being. And I think one of the challenges that we're seeing is that, you know, just in the last few decades, especially, the people who feel like they're in that place, well, there's fewer and fewer of them. There are more and more people who feel like they're really struggling, really just hanging on the edge, and aren't necessarily able to make it or are barely making it. And, you know, one big expense, whether, you know, their car breaks down or they have a health problem, will, you know, put them underwater.
Yeah. And it seems like, there are various ways to measure this, but by almost all of these measurements that I've seen, and I've seen a lot of them, we had a pretty strong middle class and relatively low economic inequality in the 1950s, 60s, and in the early 70s. But, you know, today, inequality is at something right around a 90-year high or so. And so the obvious question is, you know, what the heck happened? So what's your take on how we managed to go from where we were then, not all that long ago, really, to where we are now?
So there were a lot of things that happened, and I think you're exactly right in how you've described the post-World War II era. We went through a period of about 30 years where lots of things were going pretty well. They were directionally in the right direction. Incomes were up. GDP was up. Economic inequality was shrinking. People were doing better. And there was a lot of things that led to this. So the first is, during the Depression and World War II, we took a lot of policy actions to try to make this happen. We regulated finance through Glass-Steagall and creating the Securities and Exchange Commission. We invested heavily in the kinds of things that would create jobs and innovation, like highway system in the 1950s, infrastructure throughout the country in lots of different places during the Depression, and scientific development as well, research and development throughout this period. And then the other thing that we did is we tried to create opportunity for people and also to help the people who were doing the worst, who were the worst off. So the GI Bill right after World War II creates opportunity for millions of people back from the war and for their families. And in addition, starting in the 30s and moving through the 60s, we do a lot of things to help the very poor. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Head Start, these are all things that really lifted up the bottom. And so in this period, we were both very concerned with wealth and power. We had very, very high top marginal tax rates, and we had pretty serious regulation to ensure that financial markets didn't go crazy and create a boom and bust cycle filled with panic and speculation. And that created stability and context for a rising, growing middle class. And then a lot of things changed. Starting in especially the 1980s, we moved to a context where we shifted toward deregulation in finance and in a lot of other sectors. We cut taxes significantly, especially for the wealthiest people. We stopped really enforcing in a strict way our antitrust laws. And a combination of those things and other policy choices meant that things shifted. And what has happened in the last generation is that instead of seeing growth going up, 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 and median wages for ordinary workers going up, 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 we see growth going up and we see wages staying pretty stagnant. And that's part of the challenge that we have today is trying to reverse that.
Now, I'm sure you're familiar with what's probably the most common conservative response to that is that those changes in the 80s to the present really were necessary because of largely globalization and technological change. And I would guess that you probably don't entirely buy that, but I'm curious as to how you respond to that, what I think is the most common critique of that.
So the fundamental thing I think that people don't talk much about is that globalization isn't a natural process, the motions of the moon around the earth
right.
Operating by the laws of gravity. Globalization is a thing that is created by law. We have laws that allow for and block, in some cases, international financial flows. We have laws that allow for and block the transmission of goods and services. Those are trade laws and policies and tariffs, and we've had those since the beginning of the Republic. Technology is actually pretty similar. There's a lot of inventions that happen, but the ways that technology is used and deployed are things that we control, and we control them through laws. And so we have laws around everything. The reason why your toaster doesn't explode when you plug it in is because we have laws that require looking at that to make sure it's safe. So I think one of the challenges for people who want to say everything is just about globalization and technology is that while I do think a big chunk of the changes are about both of those things, both on the trade front and on the technology and automation front, that doesn't mean that we are helpless in the face of those kinds of changes. Those are actually changes that we as people living in a democracy who get to set the laws for the kind of society that we want to have. We get to choose what kind of globalization we want. We get to choose how we want technology to interface with our lives. And that's something that's really important, and I think that people forget. And I'll just give you one other brief example of this. Just to make it clear, you know, I think a lot of people just wonder what to do about technology today. But I'll give you another piece of technology, the television. It turns out that there isn't a lot of salacious, inappropriate television on in the middle of the daytime when children might be watching. And the reason why is we have decided as a society to regulate that and to not allow it. That's an example of a technology that could lead to bad consequences. But as a democracy, we've come together and said, we don't want to live in that world. We want a different route where, you know, kids can watch TV when they get home from school and there isn't any risk of them being exposed to things that are inappropriate for their age. So that's the kind of thing where we've just made choices as a society and we can make choices again.
Okay. Now, assuming we don't make the right sort of choices, I think at one point I got the sense that if we keep on going in this direction, that there are two primary outcomes, I guess, that might happen. For instance, one being an oligarchy, the other one being some sort of a demagogue taking charge. And now, of course, there are already some people who argue that we're already in an economic oligarchy, and we're not really the republic anymore. And I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, so one of the, you know, striking things is how many, there are political scientists now and other commentators who just flat out declare that we're now in an oligarchy because policy responsiveness is so low for what it really means to be a democracy. And so much of our policies are skewed towards helping the wealthy and the well-connected. And I think there's something to this. You know, one of the striking things is that for a middle-class constitution to change, you don't have a constitutional convention where everybody gets together and says, hey, let's, you know, it's time to become an aristocracy or an oligarchy. It doesn't work that way. The way it works is it slowly, quietly descends from republic or democracy into oligarchy, and you don't realize it. And that's the challenge, and I think, you know, at some point, you have to call it what it is. And a lot of political scientists now, or at least some political scientists now, think it's fair to say that. And some of the leading scholars of oligarchies throughout history and throughout the world have characterized America in those terms now.
What about the demagogue path? Do you think that we're vulnerable to that right now?
Yeah, so I think one of the real challenges is that we are vulnerable to a system that constantly may jump from demagogue to demagogue, in part because when you have a rigged political and economic system, the people are not stupid. They know it. They see it. They live it. And they want something different. And the question is, how do you get that? How do you get that kind of reform? And one thing that happens in these contexts, and historically people, you know, comment about this, is that you get a populist revolt. And populist revolts are not anarchy. They're not mob rule with, referenda for every single bill that might go through or something like that. What they actually run through is leaders, and they'd require leaders to kind of channel the people's will and try to fight the system and try to end the corruption. And that leaves open a lot of space for demagogues to try to gin up and rely on the kind of populist energy that's lying around latent in society. I think we see the rise of populism now around the world and in our own country. And I think it may, you know, in some ways that is part of what is happening right now, is this response to a system that people that people feel is rigged.
Right. And again, this is not just a phenomenon on the left or the right. We see it on both ends of the spectrum.
On both ends of the spectrum, in multiple countries, there's a kind of resurgence of interest and excitement in more populist style candidates, and it's around this same set of arguments that the system is very corrupt and it's not really responsive to what people actually want and need.
So, you know, the truly important question is where this leaves us. I mean, if we accept the fact that we've strayed from our Republican roots and our constitution's in crisis because the middle class is in crisis, the natural question is, well, what steps would help both, I think, on an institutional level? And I bet a lot of listeners who, you know, believe that you're onto something here would say, well, what can I do? I think those are both, you know, really important questions.
Yeah, so I think the first thing is, if you want to talk about policies, there are a lot of things that we can do policy-wise, and I'll briefly just take you back to the Progressive Era, because it's one that's very similar to our time. So about 100 years ago, a little bit more than 100 years ago, we were in the Gilded Age. People now talk about today as the New Gilded Age. But in the original Gilded Age, there was a lot of economic inequality. A lot of the same problems we're facing today in terms of corruption. And what the people then did, the populists in the late 19th century and then the progressives in the early 20th century, is they tried to attack this in two ways. And the first was to try to make the economy more democratic. And so Teddy Roosevelt said there can be no such thing as political democracy unless there's also something approaching an economic democracy. And to create economic democracy, they created the first antitrust laws. They created a constitutional amendment so that there could be an income tax and so that wealthier people would have to pay more. They created minimum wage laws, maximum hours legislation. They banned child labor. They did a lot of things to help make a more level and democratic economy. Then the second thing they did is they wanted to make sure that the wealthiest and most powerful people in the economy couldn't take over the government. And so the first campaign finance regulations in any serious way at the federal level come in during this time period. And we also see a constitutional amendment for the direct election of U.S. senators by the people, who are less corruptible than having U.S. senators selected by state legislatures, which is how it had been before, because often the state legislators could be bribed. And so that was what they were working on. And I think today it provides a really good model for what we need to do. We need to think about how we can make our economy more democratic, and that's in things like antitrust and tax policy and labor policy and wages. But we also need to think about things that will insulate our political system from the corrupting influences of special interest groups, and rather have our political system be more focused on public service rather than serving only the set of narrow interests right. of a few people.
And this is something, right, that happened both at the national level and at the state level with the progressives. And I would presume that that's the kind of thing.
And I would add to that the municipal level, too, at cities. Right. Cities as well were very active in that time period.
Yeah, absolutely. So what about, you know, the individual listener says, that's great. I want to be part of a positive change. You know, what can I do? Are there any, you know, organizations, resources, actions, anything that you would recommend that people maybe do who want to be an agent of change here?
Well, so I would say there's two things that people should do. The first is that it's really important to be active in every possible way in as a citizen in public affairs. And that means speaking out, it means going to town meetings, it means voting, it means writing letters to the editor, it means talking to people, you know, at the grocery store or whatever it is and wherever it is, being active and engaged. And, you know, one of the striking things about how change works is people get out there and push for it. Change doesn't just come from the top. It requires leaders, requires people in Congress who are willing to, you know, pass the bills and so on. But it also requires massive social movements in order to force those people to pass those bills and in order to give them the support they need to fight those fights inside Congress to get those bills passed. And so we need that outside energy in order to get people on the inside to do what we want them to do, but also so that they have the space to be able to do it. So I think being very active is a really important piece of this. The second thing that I would say is that I think it's really important for people to see how we don't have to make choices between, you know, one group or another necessarily, and that we can focus on building an inclusive society and economy for all of us. And that's got to really be part of our focus going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Well, with that, we will close. Professor Ganesh Sitaraman, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you. It's been great fun to be here.
That's it for this episode. I hope you liked what you heard. And also remember that there's that Politics Guys listener survey. We'd really appreciate it if you could help us out by answering that. Again, it's quick and easy and simple, 7 questions, all of them optional. And to take it, go to politicsguys.com and look for the listener survey post, and you'll see the link right there. You know, listener support is what keeps this show going, especially now that we're ad-free, and we really do appreciate it. If you're interested in joining our great group of Politics Guys supporters, you can go to politicsguys.com and click on the Patreon or PayPal links you'll see there. And if you want to support the show without spending anything, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, or whatever other podcast app you use. Share this episode with your friends and followers, and pass along our new show posts and tweets on Facebook and Twitter. Leaving reviews of the show and ratings on iTunes also helps. If you've got a question, comment, correction, or just want to share some random thought with us, you can reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. Our Facebook page, where you can message us and where we post stuff throughout the week, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter, @politicsguys. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.